From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, a look at juvenile justice. Azi Kambuli, a South African teenager in Mississippi, avoids the death penalty by plea bargaining. We'll talk with his mother about his case, his country, and justice in America. Then a juvenile justice bill in Congress says offenders as young as 13 should be tried and jailed as adults. We'll hear from a father of a teenage son who committed suicide in an adult prison. And we'll talk with a former gang member about alternatives to incarceration. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Despite criticisms on a poll reflecting deep national doubt about his new dialogue on race, President Clinton says he's committed to using his office as a bully pulpit for solving racial problems. In television interviews yesterday, Clinton sought to dispel his critics' argument that the campaign, which revolves around having Americans speak out before a presidential advisory board, will be a lot of talk with little or no official action. But when asked about a specific action that could be taken, pushing a proposal pending in Congress to extend an apology to Black Americans for slavery, Clinton was noncommittal. Threatened with a possible court-martial, the Army's most senior enlisted soldier says racism is behind charges he sexually harassed four women. Sergeant Major Gene McKinney said investigators suggested to witnesses that he was, quote, only interested in white women as an explanation for why his accusers apparently were all Caucasian. This according to the New York Times today. McKinney charged that the ethnicity of the people interviewed determined their credibility in the eyes of the investigators. More than 50 major health advocacy and minority groups have written a letter to President Clinton urging him to lift a ban on funding AIDS programs that allow drug users to swap dirty needles for clean ones. The groups, including the American Public Health Association and the National Urban League, say lifting the ban would help heal race relations. Just a week before a UN Earth Summit, the Clinton administration is shying away from backing any specific target for cutbacks in carbon dioxide and other gases to combat global warming. Under mounting pressure from U.S. industry, Washington is keeping its negotiating options open in the lead-up to a critical conference in Japan this December, when governments are to commit by treaty to rolling back greenhouse gases. American businesses worried that stifling emissions will mean stifling the economy is mobilizing big names and money in a campaign focused on the Kyoto conference. Commitments are what environmentalists have sought from President Clinton and other leaders who will address next week's UN General Assembly special session. The Green campaigners want governments to close the negotiating gap and add detail now to the developing treaty, the Climate Change Convention. But they sound resigned to more difficult months ahead. Palestinian threw stones at Israeli troops in the West Bank town of Hebron for a third day today, and a Jewish settler opened fire on Palestinians during a land protest in the Gaza Strip. In Jerusalem, dozens of Palestinians rallied outside the U.S. consulate to protest last week's U.S. Congress resolution recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital. The Palestinians want a sector of the city for a future capital. And European leaders fighting to save plans for a single currency and prepare the European Union for expansion open what could be a bruising summit today with the Union's future at stake. The hottest item on the agenda is keeping the euro, the new currency, on track for its launch in 1999. The summit has to deal with France's new socialist-led government, which suddenly has objections. They're signaling they will seek to turn this week's European Union summit in Amsterdam into a conference for creating jobs and coordinating economic policies, as well as for reforming the EU. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Last week, Azi Kambuli pled guilty to carjacking and being an accessory to murder. Just a few weeks ago on Democracy Now!, we heard about his case. Azi Kambuli is a South African teenager who faced the death penalty in Mississippi. Young Azi had come to the United States with his mother, Busisiwe Chabeli, who was studying psychology at Jackson State University. But Ozzie found himself in trouble with the law, and he was soon facing a politically ambitious prosecutor who charged him with accomplice to murder. Even though the teenager cooperated with police fully and was not even within earshot when a friend pulled the trigger, the Mississippi prosecutor announced his intention to seek the death penalty against Ozzie. Last week, the judge in the case said Ozzie should not be given a harsher penalty than the triggerman, who got life in prison without parole. The case has sparked an international campaign to save Ozzie's life, and here to update us on some breaking developments is the mother of Ozzie Kambule, Busisiwe Chabele. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yeah.
Well, why don't you tell us what happened last week? What exactly did Ozzie plea bargain to?
The plea that was offered to him was that he pleaded to carjacking, which is equivalent to armed robbery, I guess, and the maximum that he can get for that is 30 years. And he also pleaded to accessory after the fact, and the maximum for that is 5 years. And those two sentences are supposed to run consecutively. So that's a maximum of 35 years. And so that was just what he's pleading to. But then we are going into the sentencing phase this morning, and the judge has the discretion. He can give him the maximum, or he can, you know, reduce that sentence depending on what we present, you know, as who Ozzie is, and, you know, just for him to be merciful.
What are you thinking the judge is going to do today?
I don't think the judge is going to let him walk. I don't think so. The judge has is in a difficult position in that he has to balance, what about the McGill family, you know, and the law is very clear in Mississippi, you know, so he has to take that into account as well. The law is very, very clear.
And the McGill family is the family of Pam McGill, who was murdered.
Yes, yes. So they are also seeking justice. And so, and I don't think that the judge would thinks it's going to be fair to let Ozzie walk. I don't know. I don't see him doing that. You know, he's a very he doesn't come across as being an emotional judge or anything like that, based on the fact that he threw out the death penalty request by the district attorney. But he has a constituency to answer to. I don't see him doing that, and I may be wrong.
Lucy, let me go through the case for a minute for listeners who aren't familiar with it, although there has been an international campaign that's grown up around it. On January 25th, 1996, Ozzie was riding in a car driven by Santonio Berry, a man in his early 20s who reportedly had a history of criminal behavior.
Right.
According to Ozzie's statement to police, Berry saw Pam McGill drive by in a red sports car and stated he wanted the vehicle. Berry drove behind McGill when she pulled into her apartment building's parking lot. He got out of the car with a gun. Berry forced Pam to move into the passenger seat of her vehicle and told Ozzie to get in the back. Berry then drove from Jackson into neighboring Madison County. He stopped the car, instructed Pam McGill to come with him, and told Ozzie to stay in the car. Berry took McGill deep into the woods. Ozzie couldn't see or hear them. He also couldn't leave because he didn't know how to drive the car. Eventually, Berry returned. Later, he told Ozzie that he shot McGill. Ozzie was arrested approximately a week later when an informant notified police that Berry had been trying to sell McGill's car. From the moment of his arrest, Ozzie was cooperative. He took the police out several times where he thought Berry had stopped McGill's car. Ozzie, who was from another country, from South Africa, with no driver's license, no car, no knowledge of the area beyond Jackson, was unable to pinpoint the location. Eventually, some 2 months later, Berry took the police to the crime scene.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And the thing, though, that that is problematic for Ozzie is that when Berry got out of the car to take Pamela McGill into the woods, he told Ozzie, he said, "You turn that car around. When I come back, you know, I need to find you having turned the car around." And Ozzie tried to do that, but he couldn't because he couldn't drive, you know. And that in itself makes him an accessory. That is the law in Mississippi. That attempt is perceived by the law as having assisted Berry. Now, we don't know what was going on in Ozzie's mind. But he may have been afraid. He may have been trying to he was thinking, maybe I can drive and run away or whatever. We don't know what he was thinking, but he did that. And that in itself makes him as guilty as Barry, which is why initially the district attorney was asking for the death penalty for Azzy, because that is the law in Mississippi. It really doesn't matter, you know, what the reasons are for anything that you do during that process when somebody ultimately gets killed. You know, and so that is the problem that Azzy is facing. Mm-hmm.
So was it just last week for the first time that the judge said that Azzy Kambuli could not face the death penalty, considering that the trigger man hadn't gotten the death penalty?
Exactly.
So until last week, you didn't know whether the judge would allow the prosecutor to go for the death penalty?
No, we didn't. We were going to. Today was supposed to be the beginning of the trial. We were preparing to go to trial with the clear view that Azzy was facing the death penalty. And then it was a very amazing twist, as some people call it, when the judge threw that out. And some of the lawyers were saying they'd never heard of it. You know, it had never happened before for a judge to do that.
Now, did Azzy plea bargain after the judge threw this out?
Yes.
Why did he plea bargain?
The district attorney came. Well, you know, we sat down with the lawyers and Azzy, and we were looking at the overall picture, you know, to say what's the best thing to do here, because if we do go to trial, okay, Azzy is facing life without parole in front of a jury. That is the law. Okay, the judge is going to have to instruct the jury members that the law says you have to give him life since he had thrown out the death penalty. Okay, he had to do that. And so that, as opposed to the maximum of 35, which conceivably could come down, is a manageable figure to deal with. So it's not really, it's a pragmatic decision that had to be taken. It's not a happy decision. It's not a good decision. It's just a pragmatic decision. What do you do under these circumstances? Because either way you look at it, Azzy is facing time. So what do you want to deal with? Do you want to deal with life without parole, or do you want to deal with 35 years and then find some other mechanisms to deal with the situation? One thing that we're thinking about, we know that there is a law in South Africa that was signed around about the 1940s, which you know, provided for an exchange of prisoners, but it didn't provide for situations like the one that Azzy is involved in. And so maybe those are some of the things that we can do to encourage the South African government to start dealing with those issues and putting them into effect, and, you know, talking to the United States government, you know, and improve that law and make provisions for, you know, issues like those.
So you mean possibly getting Azzy to serve his time in South Africa?
Right. Yeah.
Has Nelson Mandela, the president of South Africa, entered this case?
Not to my knowledge, ma'am, but I do know that he is fully aware of the circumstances around this case. I have been told that, you know, he has been paying attention. Now, what he intends to do about it, I have no idea.
Azzy, your son, has been in prison now for more than a year, has been in jail. What have the conditions been like for him?
Madison County Jail, they have not treated him in any way. You know, he's just been treated by like any other regular prisoner. If there's a lockdown, he's part of that. You know, he's just part of the system. But you know, he's been able to study, and he got his GED, and he's currently working towards taking his SAT so he can go to college. You know, so he's doing something very positive with his life, by the difficult circumstances that he finds himself in. So he's really trying, and the jail has been cooperative in that respect.
We are looking at today's date, June 16th, and notice that it actually is the anniversary of the Soweto Uprising.
Yes.
21 years ago today, the Soweto Uprising happened in South Africa. Now, Busi, you come from South Africa. You were an activist there. And in fact, Azzy, before he came here at the age of 15, lived in Soweto.
Yes.
Can you talk about the significance of this to Azzy's case?
Well, I guess June 16 was a kind of a liberation of the mind, in a sense, for young kids who finally said, enough with this system, enough with being forced to study, you know, difficult subjects and concepts in a strange language like Afrikaans, and we're just going to take matters into our hands and deal with this because adults are not going to deal with it. And so it's a kind of a liberation day. It's a mind thing, and hopefully, you know, this is what it could be for Azi to say, you know, the circumstances that I'm in do not define me. I am who I am, and I will live beyond, you know, these circumstances. And hopefully there is life after Madison County Jail and after kitchens and after everything is said and done.
We're talking to Busisiwe Chabele, who is the mother of Azi Kambuli, who now faces 35 years in prison for participating in the killing of a woman, the carjacking and the killing of a woman. He will be sentenced. Is today the date that you will know?
Yes, today, by lunchtime today, we should know what the outcome is.
And how are you feeling right now?
Right now, I am mush. I was just telling my husband earlier today, I said, I can actually feel my seams unraveling. You know, it's a very, very difficult time. It's a very difficult time. And I will have to take the stand and testify. And I've never done this before. So it's going to be a very emotional time, a very difficult time. But I'm just going to do the best that I can for my son.
Busi, what do you plan to say today at the sentencing hearing?
I have so many things in my mind that, you know, that just go help. My mind is just all over the place. But there's one thing that I do know. No matter what, I'm going to stand by Azi. He's my son. I love him. I believe in him. I know he never had any intention to take Pamela McGill's car, no intention to kill her or kidnap her or anything like that. I know that. And that is the truth. Unfortunately, the legal system is not so much about the truth. It's about rules and the law. And so it's unfortunate. But I'm going to stand by him no matter what. And I'm going to be there for him. And when he comes out of that place, we're going to be here for him. He's got a place to go to. We love him. We'll stand by him no matter what.
Busi Chabele, you came to this country to study psychology at Jackson State. You've come to Mississippi, quite a difficult state when it comes to criminal justice. Mississippi Governor Kirk Fortas has stated unequivocally he intends to make Mississippi the capital of capital punishment. For him, the whole future of law enforcement lies rooted in the past. He's removed radios and TVs from prisons and reintroduced zebra suits as inmate uniforms. He also supported legislation that would have required violent criminals to receive 6 months of mandatory flogging upon entry into the state penitentiary. After Fortas's changes were implemented, the state penitentiary system experienced its biggest inmate riot in years. You're in Mississippi, an interesting state.
Oh, yeah. Very, very interesting. But I'm just going to be very careful about that, lest the district attorney asks me, what did you mean by such and such a statement on the radio today?
Well,
yes. But it is a difficult place to be in. It is a very difficult place to be in.
Do you plan to return to South Africa?
Yes, ma'am. The minute they let us go, whenever that may be, I am ready to go. I am ready to go.
Any last reflection on similarities between South Africa before or after apartheid and Mississippi?
Well, both countries have, South Africa is a country and Mississippi is a state. They've gone through a lot of changes. You know, Mississippi had slavery. You had the civil rights movement, the marching, the demonstrations. You had laws coming into place to address those iniquities of the past. You had affirmative action, and it's a constant struggle to get racial reconciliation. And South Africa has been in a similar situation where we had apartheid, you know, oppression, police brutality, and all that, and coming to a point where today we have a black president, you know, who incidentally was locked up by the same white people, you know, who thought he was a terrorist and a communist then, you know, and we are moving towards that point of racial reconciliation. You know, so you have those similarities. And the one thing that stands out in my mind is that South Africa today, as barbaric as some people may think it was, does not have the death penalty today. You know, and that's the only, that's a difference that stands out in my mind very starkly when I look at South Africa today and Mississippi today.
Well, Busisiwe Chabele, I want to thank you very much for joining us. I know you're racing off to the court now for the sentencing of your son, Azi Kambule. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we continue on the subject of criminal justice, and particularly juvenile justice in this country, looking at a bill that's before Congress right now. Stay with us. Welcome to the second part of Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For months, the media has been filled with horror stories warning about a new brand of youth offender, the super predator. And Congress has responded quickly to the new panic, proposing harsh new action against young offenders, despite the continued decline in national crime figures. Just this past month, the draconian new juvenile justice bill cleared the House of Representatives. It offers $1.5 billion to the states if they meet new standards of severity in the way they treat young offenders. Among other things, the bill calls for a drastic expansion in the prosecution of children, including 13-year-olds, in adult court. And those convicted would, in many instances, have to be confined in adult prisons. Joining us to talk about the juvenile system and the effect of treating children as adults are a number of guests. We're going to start with Rodney Hewlin, who is a leather craftsman from Beaumont, Texas, whose teenage son was convicted of an arson which caused no injuries and less than $500 in damage. Rodney Jr. was sentenced to 8 years in prison. And I won't finish telling this story. I'll let his father, Rodney Hewlin, tell it. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Well, why don't you just tell us the story of your son, Rodney Jr.?
Well, after being convicted on the arson charges on a second-degree felony there, he received 8 years. He was sentenced to Abilene, a small unit up there in Middleton, which he seemed to be adjusting well to being incarcerated for about 8 months. But then was moved to the Clemens unit in Brazoria County, which apparently was being ran totally different. And the system apparently was different. Within 6 days, he was raped, and then it continued beatings and assaults. He was being assaulted for his money and meal card and things like of that nature. And he went in front of the warden, asked for a protective custody. The warden more or less laughed that off. The guards knew about it. I've got a statement from one of the guards on some of the beatings, and the guards were aware of it without any help from the guards.
This was an adult prison?
Yes, it is. It is an adult and younger prison, is the way it's stated. It is indeed an adult prison. He writes in his letters that there are he is housed with people 30 years and older. Well, not housed, but there are inmates there 30 years and older.
And how old was Rodney Jr.?
He was 17.
So what happened?
After apparently he realized that the system was not going to protect him, He apparently couldn't deal with the fact of the beatings and the assaults, and decided to take his own life, unfortunately. He didn't see another way out.
In reading the record of the case, he had a friend in prison who turned to the prison guard right before Rodney took his life and said he's in big trouble.
Yes, this is what really upsets me, is the fact that it could have been prevented and should have been prevented. The guard reluctantly did his job, and that is the job of the guards there, security and safety of the inmates, and just total neglect of that, total neglect. The inmates did tell the guard. They handed him a letter, which the guard just put in his pocket, and was also verbally told that my son was fixing to take his life, and to no help on that day, the guard just walked away and came back approximately 15 minutes later to look into my son's cell and found him hanging.
What was in that letter?
Well, from what I'm told, it was briefly, it said my son was tired of prison life. He was tired of living, and he was going to end it. I have not seen it. I've only been able to hear a few excerpts that the inmates had told me, but they turned the letter over to Eternal Affairs, and I have not yet gotten to see that letter, but I hope to in the future.
Was the jail he was in before he was switched to this prison where he was raped and brutalized, was the first one for young people, or was it also for adults?
I really don't know. That is, I haven't gotten into that part because I just my concern was the Clemens unit as to the difference in the treatment there, and apparently the protection too. But I do not know if the Middleton unit in Abilene is a juvenile facility or if it's an adult. But apparently it's ran a lot stricter and with better care.
How did Rodney end up getting 8 years in prison for an arson that resulted in less than $500 in damage?
I wish I knew the answer to that too, because that certainly shouldn't have gotten that far in our system. I don't think a first offender with a clean background should have gotten a sentence that harsh. And for whatever reason he did, it certainly proved out to be fatal on this occasion.
Mr. Hewlin, he wrote to you throughout his life in prison, right?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
How long was he in prison for?
Almost a year and four months total.
And what did he tell you? What was the progression of those letters?
As soon as he hit the Clemens unit, that was a total different change. He feared for his life. I mean, he stated that frantically, that he was scared he was going to die there. He apparently knew there was something definitely wrong in that system. And but everything happened so fast, and there wasn't anything being done. He had to go through the channels to try to get protection, but nothing was being done about it. It was just overlooked, just put aside for whatever reason. I don't know. They apparently didn't think this was a big issue. It's juvenile safety.
I was interested in the fact when he was switched to the second prison, right after he was first raped and ordered an HIV test, he did request to be placed in protective custody, as you said, mm-hmm. but the warden said that he didn't meet the emergency grievance criteria.
Yes.
Which is what?
That's something I do not know. I don't know what their standards are for that. I don't know what it would take if this doesn't qualify for it. I just can't imagine what would.
We're talking to Rodney Hewlin, who is speaking to us from Beaumont, Texas. His teenage son convicted of an arson, which caused no injuries and less than $500 in damage. Rodney Jr. was sentenced to 8 years in prison, of which he served about a year. And in the second prison he was switched to, he was raped and beaten by adult inmates. And eventually he took his own life. We're also joined by several other people. We're joined by Vincent Schiraldi, the head of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, a nonprofit public policy research group based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Vincent Schiraldi.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you relate Rodney Hewlin's story to what is going on in Congress right now? Explain what happened in these last few weeks with the passage of the Juvenile Justice Bill.
Well, you know, I think the most important part of your interview just now that when you asked that helps to understand that is when you asked, you know, how could a kid on his pretty much his first offense, this was too, wasn't a habitual fire setter or anything like that. Rodney had one prior contact, not serious, and then you know, this one nonviolent property offense that ended him up in 8 years in prison. And, you know, you asked how could a guy get 8 years and how could a kid get 8 years in an adult prison for that? And I think that that's the key question. And the answer to that is the same answer as what you talked about before. How could somebody, you know, propose putting stripes back on inmates and flogging them for 6 months? I think the issue has gotten way away from public safety, way away from sound public policy and what's good for America, and it's really narrowed very much down to what's good for a particular politician looking to aggrandize themselves and looking to make hay on juvenile crime, adult crime, drugs, whatever the problem du jour is. And so in order to be able to understand how we've gotten where we are, you have to sort of look at it in that perspective. I don't think there's a lot of good public policy going on. I don't think there's a lot of concern for public safety. I think there's a lot of concern for elevating otherwise mediocre political careers to the point where you can get CNN interviews and Nightline.
Well, let's talk specifically about the bill that passed in Congress just a few weeks ago. What exactly does it say? It hasn't yet been passed by the Senate, but it has been by the House.
Right. It offers $1.5 billion to the states, and in order to get that $1.5 billion, they have to do a number of things. One of them is they have to allow juveniles to be tried as adults at the sole discretion of the prosecutor or mandatorily. In other words, automatically. You commit crime X, you're tried as an adult. That's one thing. The other thing is it opens up the records of juveniles, so if they commit a crime 10, 15, 20 years later, that can come back to haunt them. It also requires that a punishment be meted out at every time a kid is convicted of an offense, whereas a great many offenses now by juveniles are handled informally so that there's no formal process. They don't get sucked further into the system. And 70% of the kids who get arrested once never get arrested again. So it's a considerable expense. And the last thing is it requires parental responsibility laws on the part of the states. These four provisions are so onerous to the states that there is not one state in the union, to my knowledge, that would currently qualify for funding under the provisions of that law. So everybody would have to change their law, even though all 50 states currently allow you to try kids as adults, and 42 of the 50 states within the last 2 years have made their laws tougher.
What's a parental responsibility law?
Well, you would sort of ding the parents for the acts of the kids, either fine them or jail them or hold them in civil contempt or hold them in criminal contempt if their kids graffitied, stole a car.
You put the parents in jail.
Yeah, or you fine the parents.
Mm-hmm. So there's something interesting happening here, because while this was a bill that was pushed forward by Republicans who believe in devolution, which is giving power to the states, this is the federal government pressing states to adopt these federal guidelines or not get this bonus of $1.5 billion.
Right. And these mandates are, as I said, extraordinarily heavy-handed. Nobody qualifies right now. It's almost unprecedented. The state of California, for example, does not have prosecutorial discretion waiver or automatic waiver. So in other words, if you have a kid like Rodney and a prosecutor says, I want this kid tried as an adult and sent to adult prison, the prosecutor has to bring a motion to the judge, and then there's an argument that goes on between the defense attorney and the prosecutor. They argue their case in front of the court, and the court issues a decision. In other states like Florida or New York, the prosecutor completely has discretion over that. In New York, sometimes it's automatic. At 17, everybody's an adult in the state of New York, yet Florida and New York have the number one and number two rates of violent juvenile crime in the country. I don't think those are states we should hold up as any great model for solving the juvenile violent crime rate.
Vincent Schiraldi is joining us from our Washington studios. He's head of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, and he is sitting next to Frank Hall, a former director of corrections in three states, in Massachusetts, Maryland, and Oregon, and formerly the head of juvenile justice in New York. He's presently the public safety director for Visage Technology. Well, what is your thought about this, Frank Hall, this federal government mandating what states should do about juvenile justice if they want money, which is a pretty strong incentive?
Well, Amy, I think once again it represents an overreaction by the Congress to admittedly a major problem in America. I mean, we're all concerned about crime. We all want people to be held accountable, and we all want a safer community. And that should be the ultimate goal, a safer community. But I think if you look closely at this legislation, it's not going to result in safer communities. It's going to result in the expenditure of large sums of public money, taxpayer money, to do things which have no proven impact in terms of making our lives and the lives of the people that we care about in our world safer. I mean, I think if you think realistically about it, probably 42 of the 50 states have passed some sort of juvenile offender legislation within the last couple of years. Most of them have tried to take a somewhat more balanced approach to the problem of dealing with juveniles. Most of them recognize that 6% of all juvenile arrests last year were for nonviolent crime. 6% were for violent crimes, and obviously 94% were for nonviolent offenses. So they've tried to take a fairly balanced approach, you know, getting tough with the so-called super predators, and that's another word which we've sort of adopted in our lexicon of, you know, our anti-crime sort of fervor. But clearly recognizing that most juveniles don't fall into that category and that we need a balanced approach to dealing with juvenile justice in the United States in 1997.
At the time that you were the director of corrections in Massachusetts and Maryland and Oregon, were there young people, were there teenagers in adult prisons?
No. What we've done, and I think it made obvious good sense, for the last 25 years, the policy of the federal government and the policy that had been adopted by almost every state in the United States was to separate juveniles from adults, not only in the prisons in the United States, but also in the jails. And this current legislation, which is being considered, which I think has a good chance of passing, would reverse what has been federal policy for a quarter of a century. And clearly, you know, a juvenile is eight times more likely to be commit suicide in an adult correctional facility, is five times more likely to be, sexually assaulted in an adult correctional facility. You know, I've worked with juveniles. I've worked with adults. I don't care how tough a juvenile is and what kind of crime record that juvenile might have. In an adult prison system, they're not tough. I mean, prisons are brutal. Prisons are dangerous. We do not want to start mixing the adult and juvenile offenders in the United States. And it just is unfathomable to me is why we'd even be considering doing this when we're close to the turn of the century.
With the crime rate going down around the country, what do you think is the incentive in Congress right now? Why this emphasis?
Well, I think we're riding kind of an anti-crime wave, and I think clearly, again, I think people want to be safe. I think that's the ultimate goal. And, you know, we talk about being tough on crime. Well, we've heard the other cliche, being smart on crime. Well, we haven't figured out yet how to be smart. We know that certain kinds of programs can impact. All you have to do is look at the city of Boston and what's happened in that city over the last year and a half, where the probation department and the police department have worked very closely together to prevent crime, to prevent juveniles from killing each other. And in a year and a half in the city of Boston, they haven't had a single young person killed by a gun. Now, those are the kinds of things we need to be doing in the cities of America. You know, we're spending money and resources and energy and time to prevent some of these things from happening, and also recognizing that, you know, we need to be preparing young people for a life in the information age. You know, this is, as Peter Drucker so eloquently stated, you know, this is the information age. We've been here since about the mid-50s. Well, we need to be spending money on educating our kids and preparing our kids for the future. And we need to be working with the kids in the street and in the communities, not waiting until they commit an offense and then throwing them into a juvenile correctional facility, or even worse, throwing them into an adult correctional facility where the odds of their recidivating are much higher than if they'd come through the juvenile justice system.
Frank Hall, we're going to come back to this discussion in just a minute. Frank Hall, former director of corrections in three states, Massachusetts, Maryland, and Oregon, formerly head of juvenile justice in New York. We're also joined by Vincent Schiraldi, head of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice based in Washington, D.C. Rodney Hewlin will stay on the line with us, who is from Beaumont, Texas, whose teenage son committed suicide after he was put in an adult prison. He was there for more than a year when he was switched to the second prison where he was raped. He just couldn't take it any longer. And when we come back, we'll be joined by a fourth guest. He's a former gang member who is going to talk about alternatives to incarceration and his own life story, as we spend a lot of time on this story, because there are a lot of myths that are going on right now, and it's very hard to counter them, especially in the corporate media, as they talk about super predators. We felt it would take a little time to tease out this other side of the story. You're listening to Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio. We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And I'd also like to give out a number, which I'll give it at the end as well. If you would like to comment on today's discussion on juvenile justice, you can call us at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined now by Renee Quinones, along with our other guest, a 19-year-old student from the Mission District in San Francisco, who was convicted of gang-related offenses, including burglary and weapons charges. At 17, he faced charges which could have put him in prison for 8 to 25 years, but the Real Alternatives Program, known as RAP, fought successfully to have him tried as a juvenile, and Renee successfully went through the alternative program. He's now a student at San Francisco State. Thank you for joining us, Renee.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, why don't you tell us about your own story? What happened to you? You know, how did you get involved with the juvenile justice system, and where you went?
The first time I've ever got involved with the juvenile justice system was when I was 13. I was convicted of burglary, and I was put on probation. I went through the whole system. While the time I was on probation, I did not receive any counseling, any guidance at all from the juvenile justice system. It wasn't until I got picked up on my second offense concealing a weapon, a firearm, and it wasn't until that point that I got some kind of direction, some kind of guidance, and it wasn't from the juvenile justice system. It was from a program called RAP, the Real Alternatives Program, based here in San Francisco. And through their direction, through their guidance, I successfully completed probation. Once I was gone from the program, once again I slipped into my negative gang activity, and I began to sell drugs. And the last time I got busted, I was 17 years old, and I was again picked up for burglary, and I assaulted a female. I was with three other gang members. Unfortunately, I was the only one who got picked up, and I got the brunt of the charges. And I got the worst. I got worst off. RAP advocated for me to be released. RAP was there through everything, through all my court proceedings, through all the. They were there to support me in every and any way they could. There's a lot of different programs in Mission District. Unfortunately, I've never gone through any of them. The only one I have gone through is RAP. RAP worked for me. They do gang prevention, drug intervention. They have, well, they used to have a substance abuse program. They have a school.
So you didn't go to jail?
Well, I was there for 2.5 weeks. I was detained at juvenile hall, which is the facility here to incarcerate youth. I had a state commitment. What a state commitment meant is that if I was picked up for anything else, I would do 8 to a year in log cabin. And log cabin is a camp for young boys here in San Francisco.
And when you were involved in these programs, like the drug intervention program or the gang prevention program, were you at home or in these facilities?
Well, I was at home, but I'd go to the facility at RAP. It's like a school site every day for about 4 to 6 hours a day.
Well, this certainly isn't the direction that Congress is going in right now.
No.
They're not only talking about putting kids in jail, but putting kids in adult jails. What do you think that would have meant for you?
I think if I would have gone to an adult jail, definitely I would have never made it to college. I doubt I'd even still be alive because, you know, there is a lot of negative things going on in prison that people are blind to. Young kids do get raped. Young kids do get beat. Young kids do get mistreated. And it's like, you know, this approach is ridiculous. We're turning over our young people to convicts, rapists, murderers to be the mentors of these young people who aren't necessarily negative. They just need some kind of direction.
When you say gang prevention programs that RAP did, what did they actually do?
They would go out on the street, at high-risk times, like on a Friday night, and they would speak to the young people. They would make them aware of all these laws that are going on, like this one in particular, and they would take groups out, certain groups to, like, the movies, to play basketball, so that they're not around at a certain times, like, you know, when things could occur. They bring in ex-gang members and they share their experiences with these young people and other people who have made it, you know, who have gone successfully on to college or, you know, to start their own business or to become important people in the community.
Renee, what was the turning point in all of this for you? Because you'd been exposed a little to RAP before, the Real Alternatives Program, yet you still got involved in some criminal stuff. What actually turned it around for you, and how did you end up at San Francisco State?
I think it was the cultural awareness. It took a while for me to really accept who I was. The educational system here in San Francisco and throughout California I don't exactly agree with it. I was never taught anything about my culture, anything about my heritage, so I didn't exactly know who I was. It wasn't until I started beginning to be culturally aware of who I was and started grouping myself with a certain identity that I began I began the momentum in a positive direction. I'm a Chicano, proud Chicano. I'm a father of a 3-year-old boy, and I've come a long way. And it wasn't until about 2 years ago that I began to be aware of who I was and what my role in this society is. There's a lot of young people killing themselves on the street who don't know their identity, who don't know what their culture is. And I think that it wasn't until that point where I began to realize who I am and what my role here in society is that I left all the negativity behind me and began a positive life and began to become a productive member of my community.
We're talking to Renee Quinones, who's from the Mission District in San Francisco, convicted of gang-related offenses, including burglary and weapons charges, went through an alternative to incarceration program called RAP. The Real Alternatives Program is now a student at San Francisco State. Just some basic facts and figures on kids in prison. Children in adult institutions are 500% more likely to be sexually assaulted, 200% more likely to be beaten by staff, and 50% more likely to be attacked with a weapon than juveniles confined in a juvenile facility. The rearrest rate for children sentenced in juvenile court is 29% lower than the rearrest rate for juveniles sentenced in the adult criminal court. A recent Florida study found that juveniles transferred to adult facilities commit crimes at a significantly higher rate than those remaining in the juvenile system. In 1994, 45 children died while they were confined in state adult prisons or detention facilities, including 12 murders and 16 suicides. Rodney Hewlin, if your son, Rodney Jr., had been exposed to the program that Rene Quinones was, the Real Alternatives Program, in Texas before he was sentenced to that adult prison, do you think it would have made a difference in his life?
Yes, there's no doubt about that in my mind. I think, like every boy his age, they get into some type of activity that is offensive and possibly could lead them into a prison system if they're not guided or if it's not, caught at an early stage. And I certainly wish he'd have gotten a second chance, yes.
Do you have any programs like this in Texas?
I'm not sure. Texas is building a lot of new prisons, and they are building some juvenile facilities, but that is the problem. It seems like they're building more adult prisons and not enough juvenile facilities to house our juveniles. And that seems to be a real big problem. If the crime rate and the juvenile activity is going up, then they should be compensating for this, and apparently they're not. But they need to catch the activity at this age. This 14, 15, 17 years of age is where they're going to get some misguidance and be misled, and we really need to show them direction at this time in their life.
Well, Vincent Chiraldi of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, you've explained to us what you think is wrong with the bill that's just passed through Congress, at least through the House, which mandates states to prosecute children in adult court and automatically punishes children, eliminates confidentiality for juvenile records and proceedings. But what is happening right now? The climate is definitely not turning in your favor or turning in Rodney Hewlin Jr.'s favor if he had lived. So what are juvenile justice advocates advocating right now? Where does this bill stand, for example, in the Senate, and do you think it's going to pass?
Well, the Senate bill, we've been able to cause a lot more controversy around the Senate bill than we did around the House bill. The House bill was voted on very quickly and moved on. But we had a lot more time to deal with the Senate bill. So we brought together people like Mr. Hewlin, another young man from California who the prosecutor wanted to put in the adult system, didn't go to the adult system, went to a juvenile program, ended up in the Army on George Bush's honor guard by staying in that juvenile system rather than going the adult way, and talked to a mom from Kentucky. She came out for a press conference whose kid was put in a jail in Kentucky pre-trial, and he hadn't even been convicted of anything, for truancy, and who committed suicide 20 minutes later. And so we've been able to cause a little controversy. A full-page ad ran in the Washington Times last week, signed on to by law enforcement and prosecutors from around the country, saying, don't put kids in adult facilities. The tagline on it was, lock up a 13-year-old with murderers, rapists, and robbers, and he'll know what he wants to be when he grows up. And I think that's begun to have some impact on Congress. Whether it's enough, quick enough, I don't know. But I can't handicap these things because I'm just too busy fighting them. I think that you got to fight them with every ounce of strength you have because I think it's barbaric.
What's the timetable for the Senate consideration of the bill?
The Senate's going to have a markup this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
And what is the bill called exactly?
Oh, gee, I don't know the name of it. It's one of these, violent, predatory, as many negative epithets they could hurl on kids as possible, all strung in a row, Act of 1997.
And who is the sponsor of it in the Senate?
There's two Senate sponsors. It's S-10, are Orrin Hatch and Jeff Sessions of Alabama. Orrin Hatch of Utah and Jeff Sessions of Alabama.
Jeff Sessions, who was the Attorney General of Alabama and now the new senator from Alabama.
Right. Amy, it's always interesting to me that we've passed crime legislation with so little thought and so few public hearings and real consideration of what the ultimate impact of some of this legislation will be. And yet, if we were going to change transportation policy in America or change our policies on any other major important area that affected the lives of all Americans, we would give a lot more thought to it than we give to crime policy. You know, fortunately in the Congress, we've had people like Representative Scott from Virginia and Representative Lofgren from California, from San Jose, and Bill Delahunt from Massachusetts, and a few people that have stood up on this bill and talked about the horrors of putting juveniles in adult facilities and some of the other draconian impacts of this legislation. But for the most part, again, we don't give the kind of thought to, you know, we tend to pass bills in the crime area based on one incident or one crime or one particular horrible event that has taken place, well, instead of being really thoughtful about where we're going and what we really want ultimately to have as our policy to impact on this
Frank
problem.
Frank Hall, as former director of corrections in three states, first of all, do other directors of corrections feel the way you do in other states?
Absolutely.
And have you testified in Congress?
I've been up to Congress, and I've obviously will be doing considerable effort on the part of the Juvenile Justice Coalition to prevent this legislation from happening. But I think I speak for just about every correctional administrator in the United States and every juvenile administrator in the United States that when I say that we certainly do not want to mix these populations, then we want a more balanced approach to criminal justice. And I think that that those views are reflected when you talk to my colleagues, they would certainly agree with what I'm saying.
Amy, I think you need to know, because this is Vince Schiraldi again, because I don't want to be just pessimistic all the time. Orrin Hatch opened up the markup of the bill last week with a statement saying he does not believe juveniles should be jailed with adults. Now, that's in his bill, and so I, you know, maybe he didn't read the bill before his staff put it on paper. But in any case, I think that was a very hopeful sign. I think that's a sign that maybe some of these activities, the press activities, the full page ad, the law enforcement coming around, coming on. Maybe they're bringing Senator Hatch and some of the others around to realize how out of balance and how extreme some of this has gotten.
Well, considering this bill is in the Senate right now, I just want to let people know the main number for the Senate, and you can call any senator, is 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121, especially since this bill, S-10, is now being considered by the Senate this week. Is there a difference in the way Democrats are dealing with this than Republicans? And what was the breakdown of the vote in the House, which ultimately passed the bill?
I don't know the breakdown of the vote in the House. I think that the Democrats have been marginally more supportive of a balanced approach, nowhere near as much as I'd like them to. I think that a lot of the Democrats who are facing reelection every 2 years, which every congressman and congresswoman does, are afraid that if they vote no on a tough on juvenile crime bill, they'll be painted as soft on crime by someone running against them. So we've done a little better with the Democrats, but I remain disappointed, and I'm still looking for more. I'm looking for more in a way of prevention and more in a way of separating kids from adults in institutions.
Vince Schiraldi, yours was the group that came out with the study that said as much is being spent on prison building right now as is or the prison building amount of money that has been spent on prison building, what, $1 billion, is exactly the amount of money that has not been spent on universities. That prison university building has gone down by just about that same amount.
Right, and then 1995 was the first year ever that we spent more constructing prisons than constructing universities. I think we have to really look at what kind of legacy we're leaving for the future. I mean, it's ironic that 1899 was the creation of the juvenile court. It's almost 100 years old.
On that note, we have to wrap up. A phone number that people can call to get information from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice?
It's 202-678-9282.
That's 202-678-9282. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Vince Schiraldi, Center of Juvenile and Criminal Justice in Washington, D.C., Frank Hall, former director of correction in three states, and thank you very much to the testimony of Rodney Hewlin, whose son died in prison, and Renee Quinones, who dealt with the criminal justice system, but now a student at San Francisco State University. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, assistant producer Errol Maitland, as well as our engineer in New York. Andy York is our engineer in Washington, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.